So much. It's very good to be here, and it's a great pleasure to have the opportunity to share some time and some thoughts with you. I know that the congregation has had a remarkable series. Certainly, anyone that includes Mr. Justice Sinclair is going to be quite fascinating. I think the way that I would like to frame my talk is to start with what was the premise of the post-war consensus that we reached as a society, and looking around the room, dare I say it, I feel quite at home. But I also think we're all part of a similar. Not all, but many of us are part of a similar generation that is, like every generation, we think as we grow up that the world in which we are growing up is the world that is going to last forever, and that is the world that defines us and defines our assumptions. Marshall McLuhan, who was such a great teacher at the University of Toronto and such a great inspirational thinker, made the simple observation once that we go through life looking at it through a rear view mirror. And we do. It's very hard for us to look forward and to fully anticipate or understand the changes that are taking place and happening around us. But I think it's fair to say that if you look back historically, and Professor Brown is here, so I'm going to be very careful not to engage in too much overgeneralization. But historically, I think it's fair to say that in the Western economies, the post-war world was marked by a couple of major assumptions. The first was that out of the experience of the Depression and the Second World War came the assumption that there was a positive role for government in stabilizing the economy and in so doing ensuring a growing and spreading prosperity for a middle class that could only grow. And if you consider the dramatic improvement in the condition of life that was shared by a great many Canadians, the years between 1945 and around 1970 were marked by the famous phrase of President Kennedy, when he said with some confidence in justifying his proposal for a major tax cut in the United States, was that a rising tide would lift all boats. Now, there are many things that happened to break that relatively easy assumption. And it's hard to summarize all of them in one or two sentences. But I think it's important to think through what happened. The first is that globally, the world up until 1970 was a world dominated by Western economies, particularly, first of all, by the American and North American economy after 45. And then as Europe got back on its feet in the 50s and 60s, with the Europeans as well. The Asian economies were all marked by severe, deep poverty, the challenge of emerging from colonialism. Similarly, with the African economies, the same thing. That began to change. And I always use the date 1970 because that was the year, of course, that President Nixon and Mr. Trudeau, around the same time, Mr. Trudeau went to China. It began to mark China's entry into not only the world order, but the world economy, and is really symbolic of what became a rapidly escalating transformation of the Chinese economy, so that it is now the fastest, continues to be, even at 6.5 or 7%, the fastest growing economy in the world. It is a world superpower in every respect. And I know, speaking personally, making my first trip to China in 1985 and going back many, many times since then, it's a world transforms, and it's a world that transforms itself in each generation. That has had the effect, as did the rise of Japan in the decades before, of making North Americans realize that, you know, we don't actually control this world the way we might like to. Now, some, like Donald Trump, are really slow learners in this regard. Like, really slow learners. The assumption that the world is anybody's oyster is a ridiculous assumption. It isn't. And we have to recognize the fact that we can't take our prosperity for granted. We can't assume that how we made a living 40 or 50 years ago is going to be good enough as to how we make a living going forward. And we have to recognize that the world is a much more broadly competitive place than it has ever been before. The other thing we have to come to terms with is that we paid for the Second World War and the Depression by going into debt as a country. And then we proceeded, under both liberal and conservative governments, to say, well, we'll pay it back. And we'll pay it back by raising taxes, which we did between 1945 and 1970. Taxes went up consistently, introduced sales taxes, found other ways to generate revenue and income. And we'll also do it by making sure that government keeps its overall approach as a fairly balanced operation. Starting in around 1971-72, governments, and not just Canadian governments, but American governments too, said, we're really not growing at the pace that we think we should be, and we're going to have to stimulate a bit more, and so we will start to borrow again. And we went through a period of borrowing between early 1970s and the early 1990s. And at that point, governments began to realize that, you know, this is getting to be a bit of a problem for us, because we're actually borrowing too much overall, collectively, provinces, federal government, everybody. So we all had to do some difficult things. I mean, I have the honor, as many of you will know, of having not just one day named after me, but 12. And no other premier in Ontario's history can lay claim to that, I might point out. Even though I was only a one-termer, as I've been called, I still managed to get 12 days named after me, which is really quite extraordinary. There aren't too many saints who even have more than one day named after them. And you will appreciate that no one close to me believes that I would remotely approach that category. So that process then began to wake Canadians up to the fact that we had to get serious about how we were going to deal with our economic crisis in general. And we went through a period of growth again, and then we went into another crisis in the 2008-2009, and now we're going. My point is this. What we saw as an economy which would naturally create wealth, and a series of government policies which would naturally share wealth and spread it around, has become much less of that kind of an economy. What we saw is an economy where a kid could leave school at 16, go to work in industrial work of some kind, stay in the workforce for 40 or 50 years and have an assured pension at the end of it, that world is gone. So think of the assumptions that we had. Well, I mean, first of all, the assumption was, well, everybody will have a pension. You'll have your government pension, your old age security, you'll have your Canada pension, which we brought in the 1960s, and then you'll have your private pension, which will be a defined benefit plan, which means you put in your money, and at the end of it, when you turn 65, all of a sudden the money starts coming in at a guaranteed rate. Well, that's gone. That's gone as an assumption. Companies don't create those plans anymore because they cost a lot of money and they don't think they should have to do that. So what we're finding as a country is that the gap between rich, those who are doing really well, and those who are not doing so well, that gap, after taxes and after the redistribution, which we still have to an extent in Canada, that gap has grown. And one of the things that we're finding is that as a result of that, there's an abrasiveness now to our politics. There's an abrasiveness to the way in which we live. And people say, well, you know, where does all this incivility come from? Where's all this anger coming from? Where's all this sense of frustration coming from? And the answer is, it's coming from an economy that is simply not distributing the opportunities and chances and benefits that people kind of assumed would be there. And so this is what I believe is behind a good deal of what we're seeing in the United States. I think it's behind a good deal of what we're seeing in Europe. I think it's behind a good deal of what we have seen in Canada, but which we seem to be kind of trying to move away from. And it's a challenge. Because as Jim has said, the question isn't, is there a growing inequality? The answer is yes, there is. The question is, what can governments do about it? And some of the realities of what governments can do is made more difficult by the fact that we are a truly global economy. If we just had a national economy, you could say, well, let's put up the walls, we'll all pay in a little bit more, and we'll spread it out a little bit more. That's what we have to do, that's what we'll do. Not quite that easy now. It's a little harder for governments to do that. We can't ignore what other states and other governments are doing in terms of their tax policies and how they're doing things. We don't have quite the same degree that we might have thought we might have once had to move things in a different direction. But it's also false to say that politics can't do anything, or that we have no power to do anything, or that it's going to be all left up to the market. And I hesitate to intrude in this way, but I would say that no organization better reflects the profoundly redistributive and interventionist view about the capacity of government than the United Church of Canada. The rise of the United Church and its continued presence in the country has a great deal to do with the view that social justice is not something that we simply practice as individuals. Social justice is not simply a secular activity. It is, in fact, reflective of Christian values in the context of the modern world. And that as opposed to focusing on the afterlife, we focus on what we're doing right here, which we can do something about. And so the social gospel, which is very much part of the tradition of the United Church and its predecessor churches, is a reflection of that value, that sense of ethics in life, not as an abstraction, but in terms of what we actually do and how society decides to organize itself. The last point I want to make is really to do with the people who have always, in our context, been left out of the assumption, and that is the Aboriginal people of Canada. At the time of this great liberal social democratic consensus that emerged from the Second World War, the condition of First Nations was not on the radar screen of the great majority of Canadians. Growing up as I did in Ottawa and Toronto, I would never have seen a First Nations person. Didn't see it. It's only been the transformation that has taken place on reserve in the last half century that means that a group of people that appeared to us to be out there somewhere and a set of issues that seem to us to be very far away and removed from who we are, it's only that transformation that now forces everyone to look in the mirror and say, what are we really as a country? And how do we connect to each other? And in particular, how do we connect to the people who have lived here for not just a few hundred years, but thousands of years? In this regard, we're similar to the Australians and the New Zealanders and certainly South Africans who have learned that the real issues of the connection between settlers and Indigenous people is one of the most permanent and troubling challenges that we face as a country. The inequality issue, therefore, is growing among the non-Aboriginal population, but it's interesting to make this observation. It's actually diminishing between First Nations and the non-Aboriginal population. What has increased is our awareness of what exists today. But if you reflect on, well, what existed before, you would have to say things have actually improved. We have more and more, thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of Aboriginal kids going to college and going to university. We have people moving into cities. And the most rapid way to transform the world of First Nations people is the first real introduction to urban society. In many cases, it's traumatic. It's difficult. It leads to clashes and problems and lots of social issues which are still very much with us, but it still overall leads to an improvement in the general level of health and wealth of First Nations people. And the other thing that's happening, slowly, but it is happening, is that as the resource economy moves to areas that previously seemed to be way more remote than was worthwhile, today, in fact, we're seeing that the interface between the resource economy and the Aboriginal society is face-to-face. And while, again, that will be difficult and abrasive and lead to conflict as it has, it will also ultimately, because the law is moving everyone in this same direction, force a redistribution of wealth and opportunity to the First Nations. Because that's the only way these projects will ever happen. There will be no pipelines anywhere without the support of the First Nations. They won't happen. We could do it. Country Canada could do it 50 years ago or 200 years ago. No, who? Craig is here. Who, in the 56 pipeline debate, who ever thought that one of the real underlying issues was the fact that most of the pipeline was going over land that was claimed and was certainly the traditional territory of the First Nations, but also claimed to be their land. That debate didn't happen. Today it's happening. So, what is to be done? The first thing is based on my premise that we can do more than we think we can. I hesitate to say this without getting thrown out in this neighborhood, but we can actually pay more taxes than we do. It's not impossible to think that that can happen. And in particular, if you look at the structure of debt in the country today, you're going to have to say, well, we're either going to have to cut back dramatically on how we provide for each other in terms of health care and everything else, or we're going to have to say we're going to have to pay more as we go. It's just a simple reality. You either borrow it or you tax for it. Either one. There's no other way to do it. Well, you can print it, but that's not a very good idea. But even beyond that, I think the key area of social policy that we need to continue to refocus our attention on and can keep focusing our attention on it is education. Because education is the one social policy that's also an economic policy. And while it's not a panacea, it is the case that we need to recognize that the world we are moving into is a world which requires more resilience, more open-mindedness, more curiosity, greater imagination, and a willingness to take risks. That's how we create wealth. We don't create wealth by playing it safe. But it also means that every one of those values applies to every generation. And so we no longer can see education as the preserve of the young. My mother died last year at the age of 100, and she survived her 100th birthday by 2 days. She was quite ill, and she was in palliative care, and she said, and I won't get struck by lightning when I say this. She said, I'll be damned if I don't make it to 100. And she did. The year before she died, our kids, her grandchildren, all took a decade of her life and interviewed her, and we did a video of her life. And what was amazing for all of us was when it was all done, we watched all the tape and watched and then put it together, and just it was truly a wonderful project. But what we did was we realized that she never stopped learning, she never stopped being curious, she never stopped being interested, and she never stopped being engaged. And it was such an object lesson for all of us, because we realized that, you know, this is a really remarkable person. This is a truly a great gift that we've given her grandchildren. And so I think as we look at policies that we all look at in terms of the aging population, what do? The fact of the matter is a lot of our assumptions about life have to go just out the door. The notion of retirement at a fixed age, or that somehow retirement is, you know, you work and work and work and work and then you stop. Well, that can't be good. You know, that can't be right. You've got to keep going. You've got to find a way to keep interested and keep involved and stay engaged in a whole variety of ways and keep on learning. And certainly it's true that the assumption that my father had when he joined the Foreign Service at the age of 24 and retired at the age of 65 after 41 years of service. You say, that's not a typical pattern. It's not a typical pattern because there are fewer and fewer places where you can be assured that if you start somewhere when you're 24, you'll get through until you're 65 and that'll be it, you'll be done. It's quite exciting. There are many people who are appalled at the increased insecurity that's created by this situation. They just say, well, I'd like people to take care of me for a longer period of time. But on the other hand, I think we address this much more effectively if we put education at the center of what we do. Now, as an old Social Democrat, and I still am, don't tell anybody, but I still am, really, we often say it's health care which is at the center, and everything else kind of builds around that. And actually, increasingly, I actually disagree. Because I think one of the forms of inequality that we're going to be dealing with as we go forward, we don't often think about this, is the inequality of the older, relatively well-off population with younger people who don't look forward to the same degree of security. You know, you want to say in Toronto, you're going to have a heck of a time finding a house that you can live in, you can afford to buy. You know, you go through the list of things. You're going to have less security. You're not going to have that pension. You're not going to have that gap. And we're finding that there is a gap now. So the inequality that we face in our society is not so simple. It's not, is it one class versus another class? Yeah, it is. That's certainly a factor. But there's a lot of other factors too. Color of your skin. Aboriginal, non-Aboriginal. Older versus younger. We have less poverty among seniors than we have among young women with families. So we have to look at this as a much more complex series of equations and commitments. But the fundamental question in dealing with any one of them is the extent to which we are prepared to embrace justice as a core value. And I think that whatever religious tradition we're part of or not part of, I've always thought that the simplest words were those that focused on all the simplicities of faith rather than their complexities. And the simplicities of faith are to love God, which, again, I don't want to sound heretical, is really about accepting the fact that we're not at the center. And you can imagine how hard it is for somebody who's been a politician for 40 years to say that. But that seems to me the core. The core is saying, accept, Bob, that there's something out there that's even bigger than you are. To love one another and to do justice. It's not that complicated. And it's hard to do it all the time, but it seems to me that has to be the basis upon which we go forward. If we go forward with those values, the instrumentalities will emerge. The way in which we have to do it, we can all work our way through it. But if we keep those values at the forefront of what we do, then I think we're going to be okay. We'll survive Trump. We will. We'll survive Trump. We'll survive the worst of our instincts, the worst ways in which we can look at things, and we'll learn how to see things in a more positive light. But let us not assume or make the mistake of assuming, which we did in a previous generation, of thinking that if we just keep going the way we're going, everything will be okay. It won't be. We're going to have to be, to use a current word, mindful. Mindful about what we're doing and understand that it's the product of choice. And we can never assume and take those choices for granted. Thank you very much for the opportunity.